Okay, let us begin. We'll begin. Today is Psalm 93, so let us begin with Psalm 93. The Lord is King. He is robed in grandeur. The Lord is robed. He is girded with strength. The world stands firm. It cannot be shaken. Your throne stands firm from of old. From eternity you have existed. The ocean sounds, O Lord. The ocean sounds its thunder. The ocean sounds its pounding. Above the thunder of the mighty waters, more majestic than the breakers of the sea, is the Lord majestic on high. Your decrees are indeed enduring. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, for all times. Amen. According to the rabbinic sources, Psalm 93 was sung each Friday in the temple by the Levitical choir. We don't know if this is for sure or not, but this is what those sources tell us. And it would make sense. And this tradition is reflected in the superscription to the psalm that appears in the Greek version of the Jews of Alexandria, the Septuagint. And the heading on the psalm there says that this is for the day before the Sabbath when the earth was first inhabited. So this is a psalm that is read on Friday in commemoration of the concluding of day six of the creation story in Genesis chapter 1. In a Talmudic source, it connects the selection of this psalm for Fridays for the Genesis creation story. And according to the Genesis story, the act of creation, the active creation, the whole creation process, is completed on the sixth day. And this is with the formation of human beings. And thereafter, according to this interpretation, this source in the Talmud, God exercises his sovereignty over the entirety of the world, over everything that he has created. And this interpretation of the psalm makes it a complement to Psalm 24 that we touched on very briefly when we were looking at Psalm 15 because we ran out of time. But this one was done for the liturgy of Sunday, of the first day of the week, when the whole creation process begins. So Psalm 24 and Psalm 93 are, at least according to the early rabbinic sources, are psalms that were read and recited or sung in the temple services on Sunday, and then this one is sung on Fridays. Psalm 24:1 begins, "The earth is the Lord's, and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it." Well, this is an appropriate psalm to commemorate the beginning of the creation process. And there are a number of points of connection between Psalm 24 and Psalm 93. And we'll also see there are connections between Psalm 8, Psalm 15, psalms that we've already looked at so far this semester. Both of these psalms mention the kingship of God. They both mention the primeval waters that are mentioned in Genesis 1 and 2, in that God is mighty, talk about the sanctity of God's house, all of these things. So our psalm, Psalm 93, opens with an emphatic declaration that affirms God's kingship. The Lord is king. Yahweh is king, or Yahweh reigns. Okay, and the word for king is melech, and it's the active participle of reigning. So, I mean, you can read it as the Lord reigns, or he is reigning, or the Lord is king. Either way is perfectly acceptable way to read that text. And it shares the distinctive feature with Psalm 97, Psalm 99. We also find the same phrase in Psalm 96, verse 10. The Lord is king. In Psalm 97, verse 1. Let the earth rejoice. Let the many coastlands be glad. Well, there is a response to God being king. Okay, the Lord is king. Let the people tremble. They should rejoice. They should be shaken in their boots. Okay, there are multiple possible responses to this. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim. Let the earth quake. In Psalm 96, say among the nations, the Lord is king. The world is firmly established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. So this is a theme that we see over and over and over again throughout the Psalms. And this metaphor of God as king shows up repeatedly in the Hebrew Bible. And it is standard imagery in the Psalms, and it expresses this conception that God is the absolute sovereign over nature and over history. And this kind of a conception of the divine or the supernatural as being equated with kingship is pervasive throughout the ancient Near East, and this is something that we find throughout the ancient Near Eastern mythological texts and religious texts and kingship texts, long before the ancient Israelites show up on the pages of history in the Bible. What's a little bit weird for, not weird, but a little bit striking for our purposes is that we don't find this in the ancient Israelite texts until very late in the game. This equation of God with the sovereign over the cosmos. Now, clearly he is the creator and the sustainer, but the use of this title of king to describe Yahweh as the king of the universe, as the king over all creation, as the divine sovereign over the cosmos, this is something that shows up a little bit later. We do find one, probably the earliest example of this is in the book of Exodus, in the Song of the Sea that is in chapter 15. At the end of this song, in Moses' song, we have this declaration that the Lord will reign forever and ever. Okay, but we don't find any hint of Yahweh being a king in the Sinai story, you know, of the giving of the law. Okay, and this is something that we would expect to see coupled there, because this is sort of a common theme that we find in other ancient Near Eastern societies. One of the arguments might be, or one of the arguments is, and it might be plausible, let's put it that way, is that given the ancient Israelites' reluctance to, or maybe not a reluctance, but an active policy of seeking to distance themselves from the polytheistic models of their neighbors, that this is something that is set aside. And this is a possible explanation for why that is the case. Nevertheless, we do find this word used in three names, all of which are applied to people before the monarchy, before we have the establishment of kingship in Israel, and they are tied to God. But they are tied to Elohim. They are tied to this generic Semitic term for God, not to Yahweh per se. One of the first of these, and I've listed them in your handout, is Malchiel, or El is my king. And this is the name that was given to Jacob's great-great-grandson. That is, it's given to the son, to the grandson of Jacob's son, Asher. Okay, so here's a name, Malchiel. El is my king, or God is my king. Abimelech, or Avimelech, which means the divine king is my father. Okay, Avi meaning my father, Melech meaning the king. And this is the name of the son of Gideon. Okay, Gideon is one of the judges, and it is his the name that's given to his son. Elimelech means God is my king, or El is my king, and this is the name that of the husband of Naomi, who is the mother-in-law of Ruth. And we see this in Ruth chapter 1, verse 3. All right? All three of these men lived before the establishment of the monarchy in Israel. Another thing that makes it a little, it's worth noting, is that all three of these names are found in non-Israelite texts, whether it's in Egypt, in Tel El Amarna, or in Ugarit, which is on the northern coast of Syria. And all of these date from, say, the 1300s BC and more recently. Okay, so we find these names as sort of generic names that are in use. What we don't find at all is the use of the word Melech with any of the prefixes or suffixes that indicate Yahweh. Okay, we don't find Yo Melech or Melech Yahu, which is sort of the Yah is the typical suffix that we find for names that have to do with Yahweh, like Yoshua, you know. God, Yahweh is judge, or Yehoshaphat, or Yehoshaphat, you know, God is judge, that kind of thing, or God will save, that kind of thing. We don't find that. all of this is to say that this is probably because the Hebrew Bible is really quite ambivalent about the office of kingship in general. Okay, and we see this particularly in the book of Judges, and it's very reluctantly that the Israelites are even going to embrace kingship, or God is, at least according to Samuel, God is going to allow them to have a king. And then once we do have a monarchy established, that's when we begin to find this emphasis and the language about Yahweh being the divine sovereign, being the divine king over all of his creation. Okay, so this may be one of the reasons why we don't find this until we get to later texts. Another reason for this is that, for example, in the Mesopotamian texts, kingship is described as being lowered from heaven. Okay, its kingship was lowered from heaven. This is a phrase that we find in some of the king lists from the ancient Mesopotamian text. The point being is that kingship itself is of divine origin, and it's the basis of civilized society. In the Mesopotamian model, the king himself is appointed by God. He is instituted by God. Kingship is an office that's instituted by God. It's lowered from heaven, but the king is not considered to be a god. In the Egyptian model, it has all of those things except that the king, the pharaoh, is a god himself. Okay, he is literally regarded as the offspring of the sun god. In the Canaanite situation, the Canaanite text, we find that there are each city-state, of which there are a great many, has its own patron deity, and the king is connected to that deity in some way, shape, or form. In the book of Joshua in chapter 12, we are told that the invading Israelites had to contend with 31 of these monarchs, 31 of these kings over their city-states and their respective patron deities. So in Canaan, gods, not just high gods, receive this title king. So it is conceivable that the Israelites are reluctant to follow the model of their neighbors because they are to be different from them. It is clear that the Israelites did not follow this model. They do not follow the model of kingship. And the new settlers are preferring to organize themselves as a loose confederation of tribes. And each one is led by an elder or by a judge. Essentially, what they are is they're tribal sheikhs. Okay, they're tribal leaders, tribal headmen, and they rose in responses to crisis. They rose in power in response to crises. And there are many crises. And the crises in the book of Judges are always depicted as moral crises, and they're rising to respond to that moral crisis. But as the book of Judges tells us, this political model was rarely effective. Okay. We have this model of the tribal sheikh, but it doesn't pay off very often. Usually it's going to be a disaster. And it's rarely effective in the face of these recurring attacks by Midianites, who are from modern southern Jordan, northwestern Saudi Arabia. That's the region of Midian in the Old Testament narrative. Or from the Philistines, which are from the region of more or less the modern-day Gaza Strip and the surrounding areas of the modern-day state of Israel in that southwest part along the coast. All right? In the last verse of the book of Judges summarizes the prevailing state of affairs. Judges chapter 21, verse 25, it's in the last chapter of the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what he pleased. Which is the favorite Bible verse of the Libertarian Party, right? That is the political model that we as modern Americans prefer because we don't like people telling us what to do. That's sort of in our DNA. But that is not the model of a proper society in the book of Judges or in the rest of the Hebrew Bible. There are two attempts in the book of Judges to appoint a king, and both of them failed. The first, of course, is the offer to Gideon to become a king and to rule over the people after his victories over the invading Midianites in chapter 8 of Judges. He rejected this. His son, Abimelech, tried to make himself king And he tried to have it. Well, he actually did have himself appointed king in the city of Shechem, which is in near modern-day Nablus, the same place as modern-day Nablus in the modern West Bank. And this happens in Judges chapter 9, and he is going to remain king for 3 years until they are laying siege to the walls of one of the neighboring city-states, and a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Okay, this happens in verse 53 of chapter 9, and Abimelech, you know, calls upon somebody in his army, please come and, you know, kill me so that it won't be said that I was killed by a woman. And so then, you know, a sword is put through him and he dies. I suspect that he probably would not have asked somebody to kill him had he not already had his head crushed by the millstone. So in the end, we know that he was killed by a woman. Somebody just facilitated it and put him out of his misery. By the time we get to the middle of the 11th century BC, the middle of the 1000s, the Israelites are suffering a series of humiliating defeats at the hands of the Philistines. Even the central sanctuary in Shiloh, where the Ark of the Covenant was based, is going to be destroyed. And this is when the call for monarchy is going to be irresistible. And the people are going to demand of Samuel, who is quite old at this time, that he appoint a king for us to govern us like all the other nations. And this is a call that he was very much opposed to, but in the end, God instructed him to acquiesce. And this is what we find in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 6. And God says to Samuel, "For it is not you that they have rejected." Remember, Samuel is the judge. Okay? "It is not you that they have rejected. It is me they have rejected as their king." But note here that the word king, God using the word king to describe himself, is not king of the universe, king of all of the cosmos, king of all of creation, but it is as king in his relationship as the patron deity of the children of Israel. Okay, so it's not that broad sense of the term quite yet. It's not used to describe God's cosmic sovereignty as it is in Psalm 93 or 96 or 99 or the other ones that we mentioned so far. Now, the Psalms that have the phrase Yahweh is king or the Lord is king, modern scholars like to refer to them as the enthronement Psalms because they have to do with kingship and throne and whatever. And the phrase Yahweh is king appears to have been adapted from the coronation rituals of human kings. And since the Israelites don't have a king until we get to Saul and then David and Solomon and thereafter, it should not be a surprise that they don't use this kind of language to describe Yahweh himself until after this point. We don't really know much at all about these enthronement ceremonies. We know that they existed, and that's about it. We don't know what's entailed in them much at all. We have two examples of enthronements. Neither one of them is all that great. Okay, they're both rebels who are going to have themselves proclaimed king. The first is Absalom when he revolts against his father David. He instructed his deputy to tell the people, "When you hear the blast of the horn, announce that Absalom has become king in Hebron." So you have these two things of the annunciation, the proclamation that the king is here, and there is a blowing of a horn, a blowing of a shofar, you know, ram's horn making the noise. In the story of Jehu's ascension to the throne in Israel in the north, in 2 Kings chapter 9, it states that they sounded the horn and they proclaimed Jehu is king. So this doesn't tell us a whole lot about the ceremony and all of what's going on there, but there seems to be these two symbols of the coronation of a king, which is the public proclamation that he is now king, and we have the blowing of a horn. In both instances, we have rebels that have proclaimed themselves king, and there is the blowing of a horn. Now, Jehu is a rebel, but he's a good rebel, okay? Because he is righteous and he is overthrowing the evil kings. Absalom is not a good rebel, okay? He's a bad rebel because he is opposing his father David, who is not always the best guy, but he is still supposed to be the guy who's supposed to be in charge. In Psalm 47, I gave you some of the passages from Psalm 47 that repeatedly feature God's kingship. And I'm going to read you the whole psalm, but I just selected the ones in your handouts, the verses that are explicitly kingship-oriented. Clap your hands, all you people, shout to God with loud songs of joy. For the Lord Most High is awesome, a great king over all the earth. And this is one of those words that has no value in English anymore, unfortunately. For something to instill awe, it has to be rather potent. Nowadays, you know, those are awesome sandals. You know, I mean, they are nice sandals, but they're not exactly awesome. Okay, unless I had a foot fetish, they're not going to make me want to get down on my hand. You know, that kind of thing. All right. So this is one of those unfortunate words. He subdued peoples under us and nations under our feet. He chose our heritage for us, the pride of Jacob, whom he loves. God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Okay, here we have the sound of a horn or a trumpet. Sing praises to God, sing praises to our King, sing praises. For God is the King of all the earth, sing praises with a psalm. God is King over the nations, God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people gather as the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is highly exalted. So here you have this terminology of kingship. We have the proclamation of kingship. We have the blowing of horns connected to kingship. And these are God's kingship and his kingship over all of the earth. Psalm 98 states, with trumpet and blast from the horn, raise a shout before the Lord the King. Okay, so here we have Yahweh depicted as king again. And these are things that we find in the Psalms, which are mostly dating from the time period after the establishment of the monarchy, and well after the establishment of the monarchy. Some of them, we find them in the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy, and we find them also in the Psalms. So they're really, really old examples of poetry that are incorporated in the book of Psalms. But most of the psalms that we have clearly are dating from after the time period that there was a monarchy, after the time period of David and even later. So the same two elements of the human coronation rituals, the proclamation of kingship and the blast of a horn, are present in these psalms that talk about divine kingship. Now, not all of the psalms that say the Lord is king include these two elements. They don't all include horns. Obviously, if they're saying the Lord is king, they do include the proclamation, because it is the proclamation itself that is crucial there. What we do find a little bit later on in this concept of kingship and ceremony is that in the calendar of ancient Israel, we find that on the first day of the seventh month, which is in the fall, more or less corresponds with our ninth month, because remember, July and August get added in the Roman calendar, and that's why we have July and August. So in the autumn, we have a sacred occasion that is commemorated with the blasting of the horn and with various sacrificial rituals. Okay, we have this mentioned in Leviticus chapter 23. Now, we don't know what is entailed in all this. We just know that it is commemorated. Unfortunately, we don't have any other information about the nature of this festival. So this is one of the frustrating things as a historian, trying to figure out, well, what did they do on that day? They're blowing a horn, they're sacrificing, but what else are they doing? Is it just that they're blowing a horn and having a barbecue? Is it a time for gathering or whatever? What it is connected to is most likely the harvest season. Because shortly thereafter, we're going to have the Feast of Tabernacles and the ingathering of harvest and whatever. So this season was clearly the start of the agricultural year, because this is shortly afterwards we have the Feast of the Tabernacle, which is in the middle of that month. And it is referred to as, quote, the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, or at the turn of the year. There is a agricultural calendar that was discovered that dates to the 10th century BC, and it was found at a place called Gezer, which is in the southwest of the land of Israel. And it begins its calendar, or it begins the list of do this and this month and this month and this month and this month in with the seventh month. Okay, so this is the sort of the beginning of the calendar year, the beginning of the year in ancient Israel. The book of Nehemiah, as I point in your handout in chapter 8, records that when the returnees to Zion after the exile in Babylon made it back to Jerusalem, they observed a solemn assembly. Now, what are they doing? We don't know entirely. But they observe a solemn assembly on the first day of the seventh month. And we're told that the people were told not to mourn and not to weep or to be sad. Okay, this is a day of festivities. Okay, don't be, you have plenty of other time during the year to be gloomy. Today is a time to rejoice because the day is holy to the Lord. Unfortunately for us, the narrative is unclear about the nature of the occasion or why the first day of the seventh month was chosen for the convocation. But we do know that as the religion of ancient Israel develops and transforms, is transformed into what we now call rabbinic Judaism or post-biblical Judaism, we have what is known as New Year's or Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah or Rosh Hashanah, as it's said in Yiddishized English, okay, which is the New Year. And it is held on the first day of the seventh month. And the month is the month of Tishri, which is similar to the word for the beginning of the year in the Babylonian calendar system. Okay, so the months have a very similar pronunciation. What we do know is that the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah emphasizes the basic themes of God's cosmic kingship, of course, what we see in Psalm 93, and the blowing of a horn, and God's judgment of the world, and his deciding the destiny of humanity at that time. So in the celebrations of the Jewish New Year, we have a lot of the symbols and a lot of the events that we find in these kinds of psalms that are called enthronement psalms. These themes were also central to the Babylonian New Year. But the Babylonian New Year festival is held in the spring, sort of at the beginning of the agricultural year rather than at the end of the agricultural year. In both of these things, we have the theme of the rejuvenation of nature, the rejuvenation of humankind, the rejuvenation of society. Here we have the fruit of those things being participated in. So either at the end of the harvest season or at the beginning of the planting season, you can see why these things would be employed there. On the fourth day of the Babylonian New Year's festival, the Babylonian creation story would be read out in its entirety, possibly acted out in its entirety. And it is called the Enuma Elish. And this is going to connect the New Year celebration in the Babylonian system with the theme of creation. All right? In the Enuma Elish, creation is interpreted in terms of warfare, of cosmic warfare, between the many deities of the Babylonian pantheon. And this is a war particularly between a monstrous goddess of darkness and chaos. And her name is Tiamat, okay? And the winning deity is, of course, the chief god of the city of Babylon, Marduk. And he slays her. And following his victory, he cuts her in two and fashions the cosmos by hanging part of her body to be the firmament above and the other part of her body to be the earth below. And this is very similar in theme to what we find in Genesis chapter 1. In the first two verses of Genesis chapter 1, we have this sort of primordial deep where in the beginning God created the heaven and earth and darkness was upon the face of the waters or on the face of the deep. And the word that for that is Tehom. And you can see that there is a similarity in the Tiamat and Tehom. But as we saw many times so far this semester, what the biblical creation stories are doing are explicitly asserting and emphatically asserting that there is no cosmic battle between these capricious deities that creates the world. It is Yahweh who is above creation, who creates it, and who is in absolute control of the deeps, in control of the waters, in control of all that is about us. So what's interesting is that both of these are, we're celebrating the sort of the foundation of the world, the creation of the world as we know it, and the cosmos at the beginning of the annual cycles, at the, in the New Year festivities of the Babylonians, and apparently in the New Year festivities of the ancient Israelites as well. Now, it's possible that the biblical enthronement psalms were employed in the liturgy of the New Year festival in ancient Israel. That's held in connection with the Feast of Tabernacle 2 weeks later. We don't know for absolute certain if that is the case. A problem with that theory is that not all of the enthronement psalms include the theme of creation in them. This one does. Psalm 93 does. Not all of the enthronement psalms do. Even though God's kingship is emphasized, it's not always emphasized in connection with his mastery over creation. Nevertheless, we can't entirely rule out the possibility of some kind of New Year holiday existing in pre-exilic times, but it certainly is clear that there is a New Year's holiday in the post-exile period, in the post-biblical period, and they are probably related. Drawing a direct connection between the two is one of those things that we just don't have enough evidence to do with absolute and total certainty, but it certainly looks like a duck here. It looks pretty close, but we can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what we do find in this festival that we find in Nehemiah, and certainly we find it in the New Year's holiday of Rabbinic Judaism, is that God's absolute sovereignty is emphasized. His omnipotence is emphasized. His uncontestable governance over the world is emphasized. His control of the direction of human destiny is emphasized. So all of these things are quite explicit in the New Year holiday, and we find it in pieces in the earlier texts. In the declaration that Yahweh is king, or that the Lord reigns, is a jubilant celebration of the eternal, indisputable fact that this is true. Okay, this cannot be contested according to the psalm. And Psalm 93 elaborates on this royal image in the first verse. The Lord is king, he is robed in grandeur. The Lord is robed, he is girded with strength. The world stands firm, it cannot be shaken. And in Psalm 93, it's using the word to be robed or to be clothed in a figurative sense. He's not seeing God up there in a robe, and it's usually depicted in this figurative sense in the Bible. However, we do have two examples where people are seeing in a vision God in a robe. And we see this in Isaiah. We talked about this last week in chapter 6, where Isaiah has this vision of God seated on a high and lofty throne, and the skirts of his robe fill the temple. So we have this celestial vision of Yahweh seated as a king, and his robes are visible in this vision. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees the Ancient of Days seated on his throne, and his garment was like white snow. So we do have two instances where the prophetic characters are having these visions where they see God. But for the most part, we don't have this kind of language. And Psalm 93 does not use that language. It uses it in a figurative sense, kind of to preserve the non-physicalness of God, okay? That God is not going to be in a corporeal fashion. The second image that we see in verse 1 suggests both impending action and weapons of war. We wear pants, and women wear pants more than they used to. And there's a reason for this, is you can get about more easily in pants than you can in a long flowing robe. I mean, if you're going to get up and you're going to have to get moving, or you need to do something with your robe. So that's what it means to gird up your loins, is that you take your robe and you stuff it in your belt, because you always have the belt on. And when you get the robe out of your way, your legs can get around and you can do things. So it's not surprising that you're going to see this imagery here, that God girds himself because he's ready to act. Okay, so using the imagery of that kind of that language, so that he can move more freely, so he is not restrained. The expression that he girds himself with strength suggests the notion of the divine warrior, a concept which is explicit in Psalm 24. Verses 7 to 10 of Psalm 24, this is what it says. O gates, lift up your heads up high, you everlasting doors, so the King of glory may come in. Verse 8, who is the King of glory? The Lord, mighty and valiant. The Lord, valiant in battle. Okay, so he is the warrior God. O gates, lift up your heads, lift them up, you everlasting doors, so the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. So here you have Yahweh as warrior, referenced explicitly in Psalm 24, implicitly here in Psalm 93. So as a reference to a display of Yahweh's divine power, this serves as another way of describing God's omnipotence and his invulnerability, his stability, his inevitable victory in all things. What that means is that the human beings who are proclaiming that Yahweh is king can be assured that the physical world that he created is ordered and stable. If this is being recited on day 6 of the week in commemoration of the completion of God's creation of the human world, we are proclaiming that creation is good, as we are told it is good in Genesis chapter 1, but also that it is stable and that it is protected by its patron, by its king. And this confidence is all the more justified because God's throne, which clearly is a figurative term for sovereignty and justice, okay, his throne is not of yesterday or today, but it exists from eternity. It is eternal. It is unmovable. And by implication, it is not subject to the vagaries of change or the vagaries of time. And this is no small potatoes, even though they didn't have potatoes back then. This is no small potatoes for the people of ancient Israel, who are living in a very unstable world. What does it say in verse 2? Your throne stands firm from of old, from eternity you have existed. This is not just some fly-by-night deity who has showed up, but this is a permanent and an eternal one. And this allusion to eternity past calls forth thoughts of creation in Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3, but especially in Genesis chapter 1. And the psalmist continues his adoration of God with an allusion to popular notions about the origins of the universe that we talked about a little while ago, but also repeatedly this semester. We see this in verses 3 and 4. The ocean sounds, O Lord, the ocean sounds its thunder, the ocean sounds its pounding. Above the thunder of the mighty waters, more majestic than the breakers of the sea, is the Lord, majestic on high. Who is the one who is in control of these uncontrollable, destructive forces of nature? It is Yahweh. And we know this. It's not a battle between Marduk and Tiamat. It is Elohim who stilled the waters. Darkness was on the face of the deep, and God separated the waters by his speech. And he put some in the above and some below. And he separated them to make the oceans and the rivers and the lakes and the streams, and part is land, part is water. He is the absolute creator and sustainer of the universe. It alludes to the imagery of these stories, but it is asserting that above all of that, which is destructive and appears to us to be capricious, is its creator, Yahweh himself. And so the language of rivers or of mighty waters or of oceans, obviously there's a connect. You know, if you know your Bible, and these people didn't have a Bible yet, but they certainly knew the stories. And if you know the stories of creation that are recited on an annual basis, the imagery is there in your head. And so the waters are images of chaos, unruliness. And it is Yahweh who is above that chaos. And in fact, there is no chaos because he is the one who is in control. Now, we talked about these creation myths in some detail when we looked at Psalm 8. When we looked at Psalm 15, they show up in Psalm 24. And so you have these roaring and turbulent surging waves. In those psalms, they're viewed as, or at least in those psalms, but also in these stories, the waters are examples of evil, but also of disorder and chaos, the opposite of good, the opposite of order, the opposite of stability. And in verses 3 and 4, the opposition to chaos and order has no chance before the overwhelming majesty of Yahweh himself. So this is a song of great optimism and confidence in a time of trouble. Which brings us to the last verse of the psalm. Your decrees are indeed enduring. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, for all times. And at first reading, this looks like, why is this here? It doesn't quite flow at first glance. But while it appears unrelated to the rest of the psalm, I think, I'm going to make a case, that it is directly related to what precedes it, especially to the first two verses of the psalm. If we're talking about sovereignty in the ancient Near East, we're not talking about somebody who is an absolute dictator who can do whatever he wants willy-nilly. That is a perverted notion of kingship. And since we don't have a king, and we don't want a king, and we exist because we didn't want a king, and all that kind of thing, so we tend to be rather anti-monarchical. And when you're engaged in a polemics against an institution, you tend to build straw men, and because they're easier to knock down than real men. The concept of kingship in the ancient Near East is much more paternal or maternal than we give it credit for. You are given sovereignty not so that you can run roughshod over your creation, but so that you can be the shepherd of those who you have been given charge over. Okay, so kings are depicted as good shepherds. Kings are depicted as fathers. Kings are depicted with this language of providing. You're given absolute authority so that you can provide for those who cannot provide for themselves. And that is, there's a mutual responsibility in this relationship of kingship and those who are one's subjects. So, since God is the sovereign, and this psalm is singing about sovereignty, it necessarily includes the prerogative and the obligation to assure stability and the welfare of your subjects. It's not just that you get to, there are no rules that apply to you because you are the autocrat. That is kingship gone off the rails. And there is no political system in human history that embraces that idea of kingship. Okay? We don't have that. So this concept of sovereignty brings with it responsibility of care and stability is there. Now, in this psalm and in the Hebrew Bibles, God's sovereignty is fulfilled by means of his decrees. And it is God's decrees, God's Torah, God's teachings, his instruction, all of the stuff that we saw in Psalm 19, which also has this cosmological theme to it. These are decrees that are required of those who are under the protection and care of the sovereign one. Okay, so unlike the case of human kings, whose laws are temporal, and whose laws are subject to change, subject to the whims of a capricious ruler from time to time, God's edicts, God's Torah, is immutable. It is enduring. And again, we are back to Psalm 1. If we meditate on this, if we recite it day and night, we too will be enduring. We will be like the firmly rooted tree by abundant sources of water. And we will have stability in this time of chaos. So once God is conceived of as a cosmic sovereign in the thinking of ancient Israel, the metaphor is extended to include the many trappings of royalty. God's throne is mentioned in verse 2. Obviously, this presupposes a locale of where the throne would be, a celestial dwelling in which the throne is housed. And we saw this in the description of the universe or the cosmos that's described in Genesis chapter 1, where you have this sort of bubble, which is the firmament above. And it is above that where God and his divine counsel reside. And, you know, way up here in this heavens. And then this is the sky. Okay, this is in the sun and the moon and the stars, his handiwork declares his glory. The heavens declare his glory as well. Okay, so we have that sort of the twofold division there. And so it's up in this realm that we have the celestial throne that corresponds to an earthly one. And this is an image that is mentioned several times in the Bible, but as we saw in our discussion of Psalm 19, it's quite explicit there. And because holiness, and what the Bible means by holiness is this state of moral and spiritual perfection, because this is an essential attribute of God, the heavenly abode is befittingly holy by virtue of his presence and the association with him. And since God's holiness is eternal, his abode shares everything that serves the everlasting sanctity of this quality. Okay, his abode is eternal. So here we look at our psalm. Psalm 93 opens and closes with declarations about the nature of God. Verse 1 asserts or affirms God's absolute and supreme power. The Lord is king. He is robed in grandeur. The Lord is robed. He is girded with strength. The world stands firm. It cannot be shaken. Okay, this is a rather strong assertion about the might and the grandeur and the sovereignty of God. Verse 5 asserts his holiness. Your decrees are indeed enduring. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, for all times. Holiness befits your house here and here, which is in Jerusalem. Okay, the earthly house, and then, of course, the heavenly house where you reside above. And in between, the psalm lays out the implications for humanity that flow from these inherent qualities of God, of sovereignty and holiness. In verse 2, we see permanence and stability for the world are assured because God's sovereignty and existence are beyond all limitations of time. In verses 3 and 4, the seemingly threatening, noisy, tempestuous fury of the natural world, which in the pagan religions of the neighbors is personified as an evil deity and the embodiment of disorder in the universe. These forces of nature are demythologized in this psalm, and they are brought under God's rule. So rather than the capricious disorder of nature, it is the commanding majesty of Yahweh, the creator and sustainer of the universe, that is enduring. Now, as the history of the Israelites progressed, as the history of the Jewish tradition progressed, as the history of the human race progressed, the underlying theology of this psalm is going to be called into question with great regularity. How in the world can this psalm be true in the face of earthquakes, fires, hurricanes, Nazis? Okay. The events of the 20th century have sort of brings moral questions and ethical questions and cosmic questions that I do not have good answers for. How can the God who is described in this psalm allow that evil to exist if he is what this psalm claims to be? For the faithful, of course, this is uncomfortable but not problematic. There are many who have completely rejected, whether it's the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition, because of they would argue that the Lord has not lived up to his end of the deal, is how it would be presented. I remember I had a pretty good friend when I was a student in Jerusalem. He says, it's not that I don't believe in God, I just don't think he's very nice. You can, one thing about, if you are the God of the Hebrew Bible, you can take that, because, I mean, you know, prophets have said a lot worse than that to him. But it is a psalm of great hope, and it has been a psalm of great hope, especially for those who have lived in incredibly trying times. And when this is part of, I think this, again, we're back to Psalm 1. When you have completely internalized God's Torah or his teaching, his instruction, and you are that firmly rooted tree, you are able to withstand these things that are beyond our comprehension. But it's all predicated on what is taught in Psalm 1 there. That's why it is called the choicest of all psalms, because it is God's word, it is God's instruction, it is knowing who he is through that word and that instruction that we can be firmly rooted trees. Because if we're not, we're going to get blown about by the storms that assail us in this life. And the imagery of the ocean sounding its thunder, the thunder of the mighty waters, more majestic than the breakers of the sea. And if you've ever been to the ocean, you don't have to be in a storm to get knocked over by the waves of the sea to see that you really need to be firmly rooted to not get knocked over. Okay? All right, let's close with our psalm, and then we'll open it up for questions. The Lord is king. He is robed in grandeur. The Lord is robed. He is girded with strength. The world stands firm. It cannot be shaken. Your throne stands from of old. From eternity you have existed. The ocean sounds, O Lord. The ocean sounds its thunder. The ocean sounds its pounding. Above the thunder of the mighty waters, more majestic than the breakers of the sea, is the Lord majestic on high. Your decrees are indeed enduring. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, for all times. Amen and amen. Anybody have a question? Yes, sir.
I've read that the word shalom means peace through the destruction of chaos, or the destruction of a root of chaos. Is there truth to that? And if so, then shalom, when you say the word shalom, it would reflect right back to the creation story.
That's one way that you can read it. It has to do with, it does mean peace. And it's like aloha, you know, it's a greeting for hello and goodbye, you know, you're asking that. But it also has to do with the idea of completeness and wholeness. And completeness and wholeness is not chaotic. Okay, so I mean, there are many, many, many levels of what that word can mean. So it means, it doesn't just mean peace in, oh, everything is nice and hunky-dory and we drive around in a Volkswagen bus smoking dope and things like that. Now it does, which tends to what we mean by the word peace. So it's a much more potent term than the English word for peace. So I think that wherever you read that, that person knew what he or she was talking about. Because it has to do with completeness, and with that completeness is an absence of chaos and a presence of order that only can be brought by the king of the universe. So it's more than just peace between political enemies or peace between two individuals, but it implied in that word is peace that one can experience with God himself. So as I tell my students all the time, when you use words, it matters who is using the word and the context in which that word is used, because the word shalom, it can be used for everything. You know, it can mean all of the ways that we mean the word to mean peace, but it can be used to mean much more than that. So yeah, absolutely.
Could a Christian analogy to that be if we use the word joy?
Yeah.
Joy. Mm-hmm. Instead of shalom.
Yeah. Yeah, another one that I mean, I've used this a lot in classes before is we sing a song here on Sunday morning that says, freedom reigns in this place. Okay? And it has nothing to do with political freedom at all. Okay, so when you use the word freedom or you use the word liberty, which is on the Liberty Bell, okay, and it's taken out of the book of Deuteronomy, from a passage in Deuteronomy. Our understanding of liberty is not the liberty that is articulated in the book of Deuteronomy or the freedom that St. Paul talks about in his letters, okay, because they're not, our conceptions of political liberty or political freedom are very different than what liberty in Christ means or liberty in God or freedom in Christ, freedom in God means. So it really does matter that we know what we're talking about, and it's very easy to conflate those two. And it's extremely easy for us as Americans to conflate those two because those are sort of our, well, not sort of, they are our building blocks of our political order. And I think we need to sort of bear in mind that the world of the here and now political freedom or political liberty is not precisely what is being talked about in the biblical description of liberty and freedom that one has in relationship with the God of the universe. Because he is a different kind of a king than the this worldly king that when we use those terms. Yes?
There's a lot of anxiety in the church about reconciling that cosmology with modern cosmology. Do we need to do that? How do you do that?
Which cosmology? I talked about a lot of cosmologies today.
The heavens above and the stars.
The way that it's described in Genesis 1? No. That's the way that the world was understood in the ancient Near East. That's not how the world is understood today. I don't think that you have to force... Let me back that up. One, I'm not a scientist. Okay, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a cosmologist. I'm not any of those. I'm a guy who reads books. You know, I've read more books than probably I should have. Okay, I don't think that the Hebrew Bible is a science book. And I think when you make the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament a science book, you create more problems for yourself than you solve. These are my opinions. The arguments that we find in Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3, these are polemical arguments against a polytheistic world system of the neighbors. And those polemical arguments reveal to us an understanding of who God is in his kingship over the cosmos, but it doesn't necessarily, I don't think they need to be read literally as this happened in 6 days or this happened in this order, because once you start to do that, you run into problems, and Christian and Jewish commentators have realized this from the very beginning, because here, this is the day that humanity is created, on day six in chapter one, and all of the other things are created before that. In Genesis chapter 2, human beings are around before there's vegetation. They're around before there are animals. So the order is different. Now, if you insist on reading those two texts in absolutely literal forensic CSI mode, I guess, you have to do all kinds of intellectual gymnastics in order to reconcile them. If you look at them as trying to make a point and to assert who God is in a rampantly polytheistic world as an argument for monotheism, you don't have to worry about that stuff. And that's how I read them. I read them literarily and not literally. But that does not mean that the people of this time did not view the world this way. Okay, but that's how they viewed it, and they didn't have telescopes, and they can't see beyond the planets and the stars, and it certainly looks like this model would make sense. We just know more. It doesn't solve my answer to your question, Glenn, does not solve any of the problems for the people who want to. It doesn't solve the intelligent designer argument. It doesn't solve the creation science argument. It doesn't solve the evolution creation debate. Because I think the Bible is addressing different questions than those are, and that's how I resolve it. The argument, I think the fundamental building block, and this is, I think I have been pretty clear on this all semester, is that the Hebrew Bible is arguing that there is one God, his name is Yahweh, he is the creator and the sustainer of the universe, and there is order in human history. The details of how that is to be interpreted, I think, it's fascinating to me how people have interpreted those sort of larger rubric, but I think when you get into the nitty-gritty details of it, you can get into a lot of trouble as you learn more stuff. Because then you're, when you've got it all figured out, then you learn some more, then you have to figure it all out again. This is, for those of you who are nerdy types, you may have read Thomas Kuhn's History of Scientific Revolutions, which has been out for a long time now, but he talks about as these are certain ways that the world has been understood, and then that model of understanding eventually is going to fall apart under the weight of new evidence, and so you find another way to put the pieces together, and then eventually going to have another paradigm shift in how we view things. Those shifts in paradigms of how we understand the natural world are, in my opinion, are occurring in parallel to what the message of the Bible is, and that is that God is in charge, and there is a moral order that he expects of his creation. So that's my long answer of saying I don't even try because I don't think it can be done, and I've read a lot of people who have done it and do try to do it, and I find it entirely unsatisfactory. That I don't want to be dismissive of anybody who finds it tremendously satisfactory and helpful, because I know that there are those that it does. But I think that just sort of to Don's point about the prophecy stuff, we can get sidetracked on solving a lot of questions that miss the fundamental point of who is the king. And that is, you know, the Lord is king. And what is required of us is laid out quite clearly for us, and we can get sidetracked on things on the other side. So, there you have that. Yes, Jerry.
I assume a lot of this wasn't orally transferred from generation to generation in the beginning. What do we know of when things were written down, like the Enuma Elish, Genesis, and Job, and the Torah?
Yes, the Enuma Elish is a very old text, but one of the things that we do know is that the versions that we have of all of these texts are very late. I mean, the copies that we have are very late after the texts and the stories have been in circulation. As far as the Hebrew Bible narratives, they're pretty recent, the copies that we have. Now, some people would argue that it's all made up in about the year 200, 250 BC, because this is when we begin to find fragments of text, and none of this existed. It's all made up in the context of the Hellenistic world and projected backwards. I find that to be an entirely intellectually unsatisfying proposition. But the version of the text that the version of the Bible that we have is very late, you know, and the Hebrew Bible. The complete Hebrew Bible as a Hebrew text is very late. You know, it's 1,200 years old, Okay, as far as the oldest complete copies that, you know, from beginning to end copies that we have. We have much older copies of the text that are in Greek, because we have the Greek translations, and it's these Greek translations that are preserved in the Christian communities. Does that mean that the Hebrew Bible is a post-Christian text? Of course not. Okay, but so that's the, I guess, the forensic physical evidence side of the argument. But in the first week of class, when I talked about sort of the composition and the putting together of the Hebrew Bible, I mean, it's something that takes place over centuries, many, many centuries. It is clear by the time we get to around a few centuries before the time of Jesus that the community has views its sacred scriptures in terms of the books of Moses and prophetic books and miscellaneous writings. Are they the exact same texts, 39 books that we have in the Christian Old Testament? We don't know, but they're probably close to it. And the version but we do know that the Bible that Jesus used, or the Bible that Paul used, or the Bible that James used, was not the New Testament. We know that that did not exist. And we do know that the completion of the canonization of the Hebrew Bible is in the late 1st, early 2nd century. And the complete canonization of the Christian Bible is a little bit later than that. Doesn't mean that the text didn't exist earlier. So this is a really, really long process. And when you look at the Hebrew, it's a very, very long process where you have the bringing together of stories that are preserved up in the north in Israel, stories that are preserved down in the south in Judah, stories that are from after the time period of the exile and during the time period of the monarchy, and they all get edited and put together probably around the 500s BC in the time of Ezra. That time period is the standard time period when this stuff begins to be put together, particularly the narrative histories of the narrative arc of the children of Israel and Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't know if it was Jerome or one of the early church fathers who made some comments. Whether you say that the Torah is written by Moses or it's written by Ezra, it doesn't really matter. It's all the same. Okay, because, I mean, the first five books of Moses never, there's no claim in them that Moses wrote them. Okay, they are attributed to him later. But the editing process is clear that it's all of these stories are put together into a coherent fashion after the return from the Babylonian exile.
We would assume that they would have the ability to write all this down maybe at the time of Moses.
I don't think we can assume, because literacy and writing are very there's not much on that, okay, at that early phase. And writing is very rudimentary. Writing really becomes an issue in the story of, in the history of ancient Israel by the time we get to the time of Hezekiah and Josiah, when we have these major reforms and they are issuing decrees and things are being written down, and the use of writing in the ancient Near East is much more common. And there's a greater level of literacy. So I think it's better to think that these things are stories that are transmitted around the campfire in the small villages from generation to generation to generation. And they begin to be written down at much later times when people actually can write and have things to write on. Yeah, there's some really interesting books on the process of how this all works out. I use one in my ancient Israel class. I use two of them, but probably the one that is more that deals with the process of how writing influences the history of ancient Israel is a book. It's called How the Bible Became a Book by a guy at UCLA called William Schneiderwind. And it looks at what he calls the numinous power of writing in the ancient world, because only the people who have special access to the supernatural can actually write. Because we take writing so for granted, maybe because we write so poorly, I don't know, but we can at least write. and read and the, and these kinds of things. But that's a very nice book, and it looks at sort of the process by which all of this takes place. There's another one that I also use in the classes by a guy at, I think he's at UC San Diego, Richard Friedman, and it's called Who Wrote the Bible? He's asking a different set of questions. He's trying to figure out the time periods when things were written and who might have been the composers of various sections, primarily of the Pentateuch. But in either case, the issue, sort of back to Glenn's question, is how do we respond to the assertion in the first verse of our psalm today that Yahweh is king? And that is everything else derives from that. Because if Yahweh is not king, we have no business in this room. We're wasting our time. But we're in this room because we're starting with an affirmation that Yahweh is king, and we want to do what the king wants us to do. Yes, in the back, way back.
You know, as Christians, we walk by faith and not by sight. And it wasn't made that we're supposed to know everything. I mean, when I am reading some of this, I sometimes accept what God has given me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as far as all the things that are going on in the world and stuff, God is a just God. And we're not promised smooth sailing in this world, but He does promise to see us through.
I agree. Yes, God is just. In the end, it works out. But we live in the middle. And there is one of the things that I tremendously appreciate about the Hebrew Bible is that it is written from the point of view of people who are living in the middle. And you have Moses. He has no problem arguing with God and telling God that you have not done what you said you would do. The prophets do the same thing. So I find that rather liberating for our own relationship with God and our own communication with Him, that we don't just have to sit there and say, well, thank you for giving me cancer. Thank you for killing my son. Thank you that I had a car wreck and all my children are dead and I'm surviving in a wheelchair. That's not how it works. I mean, we do have the book of Job. We do have all of these things that it is perfectly acceptable to expect God to deliver on His promises. But the only way that we can know what those promises are is if we are engaged in the recitation of Torah, like Psalm 1, and, you know, studying, and so that we can be rooted and have that hope to get through the middle. So I think we have one of the things I pointed out on the first day of this class is that as we work our way through the Psalms, we can learn how to pray, and they have been the model for Jewish prayer and Christian prayer ever since they were put together. And we see that the expectations of who God is, the expectations of His people, and how His people have responded and called out to Him are good examples for us to follow. And the spectrum of proper and appropriate prayer is very broad in this book. And I think that we can use it as to strengthen our own selves considerably. Okay. Thank you very much.